Welcome to another episode of the Premier News Podcast, talking music videos with me, Rob Yuditsky, and David Knight. And on the podcast today, we're doing something a little bit different. Usually, we focus on the latest goings-on in the world of music videos. But in this episode, we're delving into some music video history. We're looking back to what many consider to be the golden age of the medium, with one of its greatest directors, Andy Morahan. Andy started directing in music videos in London in the 80s, going on to enjoy a remarkable career, directing some of the best loved music videos ever on both sides of the Atlantic for the biggest names in pop and rock. It's now 30 years since Andy's success with artists such as George Michael led him to working with Guns N' Roses at the height of their fame and notoriety to make spectacular videos for their album Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. These included November Rain, the 9-minute epic where two huge dramatic set pieces, a wedding of lead singer Axl Rose to real-life girlfriend Stephanie Seymour, and then Seymour's funeral, are spliced with a concert performance by the band, and most famously of all, guitarist Slash's guitar solo outside a small church in the desert. It was a time of big hair, big egos, and big budgets. So we started by asking Andy about budgets. How much did November Rain cost to make in 1992?
I can't be totally accurate because part of the reason was it started off a fairly big budget, but it was under $1 million, I don't know, $600,000, $700,000. Whatever,
yeah,
which was massive, but in itself, but we knew it was going to be 5 or 6 days or whatever it was, and you know, it's a 9-minute song. It's a little like a mini movie, as it were. But it kind of grew. The budget grew exponentially throughout the process for various reasons. I've termed as kind of Spinal Tap with money in various interviews because it coincided with a point where. Their biggest album, but the cracks were appearing. So yeah, I think Izzy Stradlin had just left when I started working with them, and the whole thing was not falling apart, but it was like herding cats. So basically, there were days when they should have turned up and didn't turn up till the evening, and then we had to shoot all night, which obviously incurs expense, we had to reschedule a day, or you know, and it had various problems like that. I mean, you know, kind of what I call logistical and you know, organizational problems, because it was a difficult animal. They were the biggest rock and roll band at the height of their success, and it was all kind of pulling in different directions. So that's, in terms of what people believe was a, you know, huge budget, but yeah, it probably doubled, but I cannot be accurate about that.
I guess what you're saying is like that level of budget comes with an incredible amount of pressure and stress, and anything can happen.
At the time, I mean, as I say, because Izzy had left, Axl was kind of, you know, it was the start of him really taking control of the brand, as it were. There were two or three tracks on those albums, like Don't Cry, November Rain, Estrange, which were like 10-minute kind of opus. Cinematic scale kind of songs in themselves. So they kind of, you know, from Axl's perspective, he wanted to make a statement because they were kind of his songs and his approach to do those big kind of overinflated songs. So
yeah,
what do? Make a big overinflated video is seen at the time. The weird thing for me though was that, you know, having come out of, you know, the punk era and St. Martin's and railed against, you know, the kind of previous successes of those big bands that kind of punk swept away, I kind of found myself full circle, because just after we did these videos, Nirvana happened, and that changed the landscape again.
So I mean, how did you first get into the music video world? Obviously you touched upon coming out of St. Martin's.
It was kind of timing, as most things are. When I was at St. Martin's, there were the first generation of music, first and second generation of music video directors, like David Mallett, Russell Mulcahy. Then you had, you know, Steve Barron, Tim Pope. They were the kind of first, second generation of music videos. And we came out of St. Martin's 81. There were runners in Soho. There were people like myself, Vaughan Arnell. I was at college with Sophie Muller. All the record companies in London suddenly wanted a video for all the bands, not just, you know, the big ones like Duran Duran or Ultravox or, you know, Spandau Ballet or whatever. Everyone had to have a video. That was part of the new marketing plan, the new strategy for breaking bands. So that was our way in. When we'd all kind of, you know, made little films from short ends. You know, nowadays, you know, you can make a film on your phone or however you want to do it, on a Canon camera or whatever, and edit on your own laptop. You know, in those days, if you wanted to make a short film with no budget or music video without a record company, you were, you know, we're running in Soho and basically stealing short ends of 16 millimeter out of the fridge, if you could, and borrow a bit of equipment over the weekend. You know, it was a pop, the kind of pop explosion at the time, you know, the Kim Wilds and Mick Haywoods. And I think the first video I did was for King, Love and Pride.
Wow.
And these were, yeah, these were $5,000-$10,000 videos. 10 was a lot then for us. So, but we got a lot done very quickly. We basically did a lot of kind of performance against white Sykes, basically, and then whatever you could, or we'd take Super 8 cameras out and shoot things like West End Girls, you know what I mean? So it was like doing a kind of post-grad in filmmaking. We were very anti kind of, you know, shooting on video and, you know, NAF video, you know, effects.
Yeah.
In a way, the first generation have showed us the way that, you know, you would suddenly take a lot more seriously if you were kind of shooting stuff on film. And you've got to remember in those days, right, you had things like ACTT, who, you know, and the commercials industry, who are very, very kind of suspicious of the music video business. I mean, really suspicious. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I came across DPs who wouldn't make music videos. They thought it was kind of beneath them and stuff like that. And a lot of production companies were like, you know, who are these upstarts? You know, we want nothing to do with them. It's nothing to do with filmmaking. But, you know, it was also a good time to, you know, because we were brought up on, as a, you know, film and film, you know, if you wanted to do a dissolve, you know, you couldn't do it unless you went straight into online. So you had to get, you know, someone like Jeff Axtell's to do an overnight kind of, you know, pass between two bits of film. I mean, it was very organic in that respect. You know what I mean?
In the, I guess, early to mid-80s, you started working with Wham and then George Michael. How did that relationship develop?
All the kind of relationships growing up in that world were to do with probably, you know, people you run into or had relationships with. And the Wham time, one of his managers was a guy called Jazz Summers, who, weirdly enough, managed the band I was in at St. Martin's.
Oh, right.
and then he called me, you know, he knew I was starting to do videos. George made a video in Miami for Careless Whisper, which was going to be like, even though it was part of Wham, it was going to be his first kind of solo single.
Yeah.
And that video shoot hadn't gone terribly well, so he didn't like a lot of the stuff that was shot in Miami. I think it was shot by a cameraman. I don't think he even had a director at that stage. Anyway, so he came back and said, can you shoot some stuff with him? So I shot that stuff of him in the theater with the robe hanging down. And, you know, just, it was very simple. It was half a day shoot. I don't think it was even a full day shoot. And he was in his pomp there with his big hair and stuff like that. So, But I was quite lucky because kind of from then on, he started, even though Wham was still going, the kind of videos I did with him, like Everything She Wants, I'm Your Man, all that kind of stuff, he was starting to get his kind of, you know, less teeny bop look and develop his more, you know, beard and, you know, shorter dark hair and leather jackets and all that kind of stuff. And so I was kind of involved in that process. So when it came to Faith, his, you know, first, in Wham had split up, his first proper solo album, it was a kind of culmination of a couple of years work with him, if you see what I mean. So the whole Faith look and Father Figure and I Want Your Sex was all kind of a natural progression of what he was doing. And the difference was it became this huge global album. I mean, literally, you know, you're talking mega sales all around the world.
Yeah,
and that was a game changer for me in America, because suddenly, you know, people were seeing my work less on MTV Europe and, you know, on a global kind of scale. And that's when In fact, you know, one of the videos that Axel loved was Father Figure, which is a very cinematic video. George doesn't even sing in it.
Right.
And it's a big kind of narrative, 35 mil full-on kind of production. And Axel really liked that. So that's kind of led to me into back into the Guns N' Roses thing, basically.
I know that you had a strong collaboration with George, and occasionally you might have fallen out because of he wanted to take credit for some of the videos or co-credit for some of the videos.
He had his own way of working, but in a kind of way, that was his thing. You know, he was one of those, I have to say in his praise, that, you know, he was one of those artists like Madonna and Prince and Michael Jackson. They just knew how to work that whole MTV thing as part of their whole kind of branding and, you know, marketing plan for albums and singles and stuff like that. And he was really cutting edge in that respect. You know what I'm saying? And being a bit of a control freak and he wouldn't mind me saying it to, I often said it to his face that he was a control freak. So I don't have any problem. I'm not, you know, letting anybody know something new that they didn't know, but, you know, he'd worked so hard on his kind of look and his brand. So part of his thing was the absolute control over absolutely everything he did. So that was difficult at times because he was reluctant to, you know, just let the reins off. He always felt like, you know, he was pulling the reins in. I dare say me or any other of the directors he worked with could see what he was seeing, you know, in the sense that, you know, he go, oh no, I don't like the way I look in that angle or whatever, you know. You pretty worked out pretty quickly that he liked a certain side of his face, fine, but he would just see something in himself that nobody else would see. And so, you know, became not a battle of wills, but, you know, a battle of negotiation on a lot of occasions. But then, you know, he would give me free rein to kind of, you know, once we got a rough edit together, you know, to finish it off, to grade it, all that kind of stuff. You know, he trusted me and, you know, same, trusted Vaughan and Anthea and people to do that. But it was the initial thing in the shooting which were the hardest bits with him. And there was a certain, you know, once he realised that something like Faith had such an impact, you know, I got a call the night before the MTV Awards where we were going to win an award, saying, manager saying, oh yeah, Andy, just so you know, we've let MTV know that George co-directed that with you. I'm like, whoa,
lovely.
You know, it's one of those relationships that, you know, we'd have these moments and he'd come back to me. So in the end, you have to be kind of philosophical about it. I mean, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't, you know, got into that whole American thing, you know, huge kind of music videos over there. So sometimes, you know, the older you get, the more philosophical you get about the whole thing.
Yes. You talked about West End Girls, Pet Shop Boys, which I think is a remarkable video. Now, when you watch it, especially now there's an HD version, it's, as you kind of suggested a bit earlier, it's like this microcosm of a moment and in the mid-80s. And yet again, it's incredibly iconic. They never really changed after that video in the way they presented themselves.
No, you know, it's one of my favourite videos because sometimes, you know, if you can align the stars in the sense that you've got a great track and the video works with it and it's the artist at the kind of right time, it's a kind of sweet spot, you know what I mean? And that's what you can't really bottle. You know, I've seen some of the best videos for the worst songs, but the ones that really kind of, you know, kind of fit into that, you know, into that kind of perfect storm is the ones that I think work really well. And I think what happened on West End Girls was, you know, Neil and Chris were, you know, Neil had been a journalist at Smash Hits and various things, and was very articulate, smart, kind of intelligent approach to what they were doing. Doesn't really rap, but he doesn't really sing, you know, but he has this kind of ability to narrate a story. And Chris is this kind of, you know, enigma of someone who doesn't say very much and, you know, wears some very strange and fantastic costumes and stuff like that. And so as a kind of chemistry in a brand, that was kind of defined in that video as well. And then you had this most incredibly kind of atmospheric track. You know, we had no budget, hardly any budget on that. You know,
it seems odd to believe.
Yeah, I know.
You must have known that was going to be a massive song.
Yeah, but, you know, in those days, you know, 10 grand was probably a big budget for the kind of level I was working at. And it was probably even less. They were only spending big money on big artists at the time, and that was the breakout hit. So prior to that, they wouldn't have spent a lot of money anyway. And they had a photographer called Eric Watson they were working with, who wanted to make their videos. And I'd met Neil a couple of times. So Neil called me and said, oh, you know, we've got this single, we haven't got much money, West End Girls. We'd like, Eric wants to make it, but he's never made a video. Can you come in and kind of, you know, we'll do it together? And that's kind of, and that's how it happened. I mean, it wasn't even written as a treatment or had to go to a record company particularly. I mean, it went to the record company, obviously, but, you know, it was Neil saying, I want to do this, I want to do it this way. And in those days, because we wanted something really atmospheric and cinematic like the song, but didn't have the budget. So, but you're in London, you know, you can stick a Super 8 camera out the window of a moving vehicle and, you know, move them through Waterloo Station and without anybody batting an eyelid and all this kind of stuff. Do you know what I'm saying? Didn't get any permits or anything. And we just kind of took him out for a couple of days and made it up. So, and I just think, you know, that sweet spot came together because of all those kind of factors. It was the kind of right time with the right act, with the right song.
Yeah.
And that's why it has a kind of longevity, has a kind of, still has a resonance.
It just takes you back to that time. And there's a great shot right at the end when, as you say, there's a shot out of a car and the car drives through Trafalgar Square. And it catches like a demonstration outside of the South African embassy.
That's right.
You know, against an anti-apartheid demonstration. And it sort of reminds you about that is actually the time that that was made in. It was like Nelson Mandela was still in jail and people were demonstrating about that. It's always going to be that microcosm. you went to the States, Andy, and I mean, the Guns N' Roses didn't happen immediately, did it? So what was it like in going to America? Was it a culture shock?
Well, it was, but I mean, I was doing stuff there, but I was still doing stuff in London. You know what I mean? The thing I always found about LA, which is why I never, you know, I'd always dive in and dive out, was at that time, you know, pre-internet, it's a very parochial place. People would either shoot, you know, out in the desert, or they'd shoot downtown LA for New York or whatever, or on the beach. And, you know, I just felt it was limited. After West End Girls, you know, I did a lot of stuff where, as well as where you featured the band, you had all this kind of impression of a narrative and filmic stuff. And, you know, I'd love to shoot, you know, handheld cameras and Bolexes and Super 8s out of cars and stuff like that. I just felt that LA, you could do big videos and, you know, you'd go and shoot in the studio or in the desert or whatever, but it was kind of limited creatively and you kind of got cocooned from the rest of the world. And also, you know, the pressure there to get into, you know, bigger things and movies and all that and, you know, the kind of, you know, blood-sucking agents and, you know, all production companies there, and they're only kind of really as hot as your last video or your last piece of work or your last commercial. I was just never that comfortable over there. I don't, you know, I still don't mind going and visiting and shooting there, but I didn't find it that conducive to be, you know, in terms of the landscape, and you know, I mean literally the landscape, but in terms of creative ideas and stuff like that, I always felt more comfortable in Europe. So I never fully committed over there. I just would go there, work and come home.
You're listening to the Premier News Podcast, talking music videos in association with Loop Talent. Make sure to subscribe on your favourite platform to hear more in the series.
So how did the Guns N' Roses project start? Was it Don't Cry was the first?
Yeah, Don't Cry was. Basically, Axel had decided that there were three big, you know, 9-10 minute songs on the album that he wanted to make into a kind of trilogy of videos. I still get asked about what the trilogy means these days, and I couldn't really give you a straight answer. It's, and there was the, he had a mate called Del James, who was an ex-writer on Kerrang, who'd written some kind of short story about a rock star who, you know, kind of loses ill, and you know, it was like life imitating art, basically, or vice versa. And so they came and said, oh, we've got this trilogy of ideas. But and what I said to them, that, well, the only way really of spreading this out, this was the original idea, I'm not saying we achieved it at all, but I was very, very influenced by that Nick Rogue film, Don't Look Now, where, you know, the couple who lose the child have a kind of premonition of his death, and he sees her on a barge in Venice, and you kind of jump forward in time and jump back in time. And I kind of brought that to the party. So, look, why don't we, you know, start putting in little things that maybe we tell in the later videos, and, you know, so we kind of play with the whole kind of narrative structure of it, so it's non-linear, and it's, you know, a bit surreal, and it's a bit random, and it's like, you know, let's make the audience and the fans work a bit harder than just have some one straight narrative video that is a bit naff in the end. Do you know what I mean? Let's really try and play with the art of it, and which I think we kind of achieved in terms of the approach. I don't think by the time we got to the third one, that, you know, Stephanie Seymour had left Axel, he only wanted dolphins in estranged video instead of another female. I mean, that's why I always refer to it as Spinal Tap with Money, because it really ended up being quite verbose and quite ridiculous, and it's another microcosm, you know, of its time. You hold up a window to the world of its time, and it kind of reflects the kind of madness of that whole period for me.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, November Rain, that's like the most coherent and sane, because Don't Cry is, it's like one of the most bonkers videos I've ever seen.
I think Estranged More is even more bonkers.
You're right. But Don't Cry, I mean, I remember you saying, we had a conversation about Don't Cry a few years ago, and you said it was just like pretty much the shoot from hell.
It was pretty, it's the first time I worked with him, and it was, as I say, Axel was very cranky at the time because Izzy had left, and we thought big performance on, you know, shooting on top of a building. You know, in those days you didn't have drones. We literally had two or three helicopters, you know, near missing around us on the building. And that was pretty scary. And and then all the other narratives that, you know, that Axel would take ages to get made up, and then we were using equipment where you had to do different passes and stuff like that, and it just took forever. And we, you know, ended up doing some shoots that went all night, and then having to go back, you know, a couple of hours later with no sleep. I mean, it was absolute bonkers, basically.
Didn't you lose the rushes? The whole of the first day shoot.
Yeah, one of the runners put the was supposed to take the film to the lab, put it back in his car, took a detour to score some weed, I think, and had his car nicked.
Oh,
and this where it gets really.
That'll be a warning to you, runners.
Well, even though it was insured, you know, the manager said, "You better tell Axel, and he'll probably kill you." You know what I mean? And I went. And I did tell Axel, and he went absolutely ballistic. And the only way we resolved it and carried on that video was I had to get Ridley Scott himself, because we were doing it through Black Dog. It was one of the first videos I went through Black Dog. Had to call Axel personally and basically calm him down and say, look, this happens all the time. You know, not all the time, but this happens. It's insured. You know, I can guarantee you, you know, we'll make it up to you and all this kind of stuff. And Axel was pretty made up. Ridley Scott was on the phone talking to him. So that's a pretty good story, actually. And the anecdote of that, not anecdote, but the conclusion is 25 years later, I was contacted randomly by someone on Facebook He said his mother had passed away, and he was clearing out the garage, and they'd found all these cans of film with my name on it, and RSA or Black Dog or whatever. And he didn't know that, the guy who found them didn't know they were Guns N' Roses, but I knew immediately what they were. And but you know they, because they'd never gone to the lab, they were completely useless. Basically, that's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah.
25 years. So there you go. Just shows you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about a bit more about November Rain, because mm-hmm. you know that's what we're mainly what we're here to talk mm-hmm. about. There's so many different elements to it. Well, there's an incredible concert performance for a start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was that actually shot for the video, or was that part of yes. a bigger?
No, bigger... That was shot for the video.
Right. Okay. So that in itself was like an absolutely huge production.
Yeah. We shot that at the Orpheum in downtown LA, which is a fantastic old theatre, which turned into a kind of pretty grubby porn cinema for about 10 years. but someone took it back over and restored it. Basically, had the band, Axel was playing the piano. We brought in a conductor who'd done the strings on the track, and he put a kind of, you know, orchestra together for the shoot. And then we had like an invited audience. I think the original idea was to do something very posh, you know, a bit like Sid Vicious does in My Way, and then, you know, kill him yeah. off. But I don't think we wanted to rip that off, but the audience are less important in that. It was more about the kind of scale of the performance, and that, you know, yeah. the iconic moment where Slash gets on top of the piano and plays the solo, which wasn't rehearsed, actually. He just kind of did it off the back.
You mentioned there's like snapshots of like an abstract narrative going throughout. You've got the wedding and the funeral. How did you kind of lay that out or present it to Axel?
Well, as I say, I took the approach that, you know, if we try to make a proper narrative from beginning to end, however big the budget was, however long the song was, we'd pretty much fail. I took the approach, as I said earlier, that I wanted something that was more suggestive of a bigger narrative. And you often mm-hmm. do this in videos. One thing you learn pretty early on when you're doing narrative stuff for music videos is the chances of kind of completing a story that works properly is pretty difficult, but just because you don't have the time and the resources a lot of the time. So the idea to give something more impressionistic is, I'd kind of been known for doing that, if you know what I mean. I also, as I say, I brought to the table this whole idea of kind of playing with the timeline and, you know, the idea of premonition and flashback or whatever, you know, was so people could kind of draw things out of it themselves and come to their kind of own conclusions. It makes them kind of more intrigued by what's going on. And the proof's in the pudding, because 30 years later, yeah. people are still asking me.
30 years later, people are still wondering what happened. What the fuck happened?
But, you know, in a way, I think it's a kind of strength. I'm not embarrassed by that now. The kind of verbose size of it, the kind of totally self-indulgent over-the-top thing. Yeah, there's moments where I kind of cringe myself. But having said that, as I say, I think as a kind of moment, a microcosm of its time and that moment, it was, you know, a band trying to make sense of how big and mad they were and an idea that was never really going to fit in. You know, we could have been there for 6 months trying to make a narrative that worked from beginning to end with November Rain. So the idea was, across the trilogy, was to be kind of, you know, things that might mean something in the next video or might have meant something in the previous video. So
are you going to reveal how Stephanie Seymour, you know, meets her end? Do you know?
Yes, I do know. I mean, in the short story, she, you know, he shoots her in an argument and blows half her face off. So that's why you have half the face in the mirror. So, you know, in the coffin and stuff like that. So,
right. So is that touched on in the first film then, first video, Don't Cry?
No, you kind of set up the first video is more about, you see a kind of fight between them with a gun.
Yeah.
Which was very badly staged in my book. It was something that Axel got too involved with, and in the end we just had to shoot it. But, you know, it doesn't feel very natural. But there's a kind of fight there. But a lot of that Don't Cry video is about his kind of retro, aggressive therapy that he was having, and, you know, being somebody in his past life and how it's affecting his future life. And then, of course, you got, but then you get, it all gets mixed up, because then you get, you know, after Axel's, you know, he'll say, done all that, he'll say, well, you need to talk to Slash about his solo. So, of course, that's when the solo in Don't Cry, where he drives off the cliff, and then from the flaming ashes, you come up the mountain and find him playing his Les Paul. He's actually my favorite bit of the whole video. Because that, to me, is just kind of pure rock and roll. Kind of,
it's like a pretty spectacular solo in each video, doesn't he?
That's the interesting thing, because once they started to roll out on MTV, that became, I don't know if Axel got pissed off about it, but that became one of the biggest talking points of all those big videos, was Slash's solo. But I think, you know, I think he was such a great balance to Axel's kind of verbose madness, you know what I mean? You know, wanting to, you know, Axel has very little filter when it comes to the art of cinematography, or, you know, I'm not putting him down, it's just not his thing, you know what I mean? His thing is the music, but he has these grand ideas and has very little filter about, you know, he's, well, I want to make it that big, I'll make it that big. And, you know, it's very hard to tell somebody who, when we started making those videos, had sold 15 million albums of Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. By the time we finished the videos, it was nearly 30 million. I mean, and he had people like the band and the record company saying, oh, why do we have to spend so much money on these videos? Is, you know, we can't, you know, because the band were kind of less than interested apart from Slash doing it solo. But you have to give it to Axel. He knew exactly what would take him to the next level. And what we're taking to the next level was something that everyone could talk about and still to this day talks about. You know what I'm saying? So there's some method in the madness somewhere. I've been searching for it. But there's some
right. Well, but what about the most iconic among all guitar solos in music videos, which is Slash emerging from the clapboard church?
Yeah.
How did that happen then? I mean, it's such an incredible image. Where did you shoot it? And
I'll tell you the whole story. When we were shooting the big wedding scene in the big church, which was in LA, at one point it was taking all night to do that, and, you know, get Stephanie ready and Axel ready, and the rest of the band were like pretty pissed off. And there was one take where Slash, it was like just walks down the whole aisle, you know, towards the doors, just so he could go and have another cigarette or something like that. And I looked at that in the monitor, and we had shot it. I said to the guys, can you do that again? Because that might give us a transition into the solo or whatever. Because we had that stage, we hadn't really defined what we were going to do for the solo. So we actually shot him walking down the big church. And then there's a scene earlier where Axel's on the piano in a small clapboard church. And we thought, well, maybe that's interesting if we then transition back to that church, but in the exterior now. And we have Slash walking out with his guitar, and he plays the mother of all solos. So I went around to about three or four different states with location people looking for white clapboard church out in the middle of nowhere. Found loads of lovely churches, but they're all kind of next to buildings or other things or whatever. And then someone said, one of the location guys said, well, in New Mexico, there's a couple of Western ranches where they shot things like Young Guns and stuff like that. And he said, I think there's a you know, white clapboard church in one of those towns. So I think we were in Albuquerque anyway. So we went down to Santa Fe and got shown around this thing. And the guy who owned the facility said, oh, yeah, that's on a pallet. I can drag down into the desert.
And, right.
It was a film set, but part of a different film set, if you said that. But the guy said, and I said, you know, we really want a church out. And suddenly he said, oh, it's on a pallet. I'll drag it out there on a tractor for you, which he did. And then we kind of built the little, you know, fence around it and stuff like that. And there's, you know, inside the church, there's nothing. It's just it's a set, essentially. And it kind of answered all the problems. So then we had that day where Slash comes out of the church with his guitar, and we filmed it with about you know, four or five cameras, Steadicam, brought in a helicopter for a couple of shots. Yeah, say, you know, didn't have drones in those days, so you had to kind of do it for real. And it kind of kicked up the whole dust and everything, which kind of like, it makes it even more iconic in a funny kind of way, because it's almost like, you know, Slash is oblivious to the helicopter that's just about a crash land on top of him. When we were in the hotel in Santa Fe, on the day before we were shooting, I ran into Anton Corbijn, who was there doing a photographic shoot. And I knew Anton from Vivid, you know, which had been the same company years before.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing this Guns N' Roses video. He goes, oh, I've got a day off tomorrow. Can I come out and see what you're doing? So Anton Corbijn comes out and he sees us shooting this whole thing with five cameras and helicopters and stuff. And he said to me, oh, Andy, that's incredible. I said, is this the whole video? I went, no, it's about 27 seconds. And in that moment kind of encapsulated how bonkers this whole thing had become. And and he took some lovely pictures of Slash, actually, which I think are in one of his books. But, yeah, that's a nice little anecdote to that story.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things will stand forever as amongst the great rock and roll moments, but also obviously music video moments. And
yeah, and I also think it's you know, what's interesting from that point on is that every single big hair band in America try to outdo each other. Everybody tried to outdo everybody else from then on in to you know, to kind of top them. You know, like, you know, it became like a competitive thing, which was quite amusing to me.
So what's your favorite Guns N' Roses video?
Well, weirdly enough, I'd done these three huge, overblown, kind of epic cinematic videos, which, you know, bits of those I like, bits of those I can't watch to this day, only probably more from the memories than anything. But I persuaded them to let me shoot. There was on the Use Your Illusion album, there's a track that kind of was the precursor of that album, The Spaghetti Incident, where they went kind of back to their roots and made a punk record. And this was like a, you know, a punk, you know, thrash metal type song called Garden of Eden. And we were shooting something else on Estranged. And I said to Slash, we were just talking about playing. He said, you know, we've been playing all these huge stadiums, but, you know, we'd much rather play, you know, at the midnight show at the Rainbow on Sunset, you know what I mean? And that's, yeah, you know, that's kind of where we're happiest, really. I said, oh, I'd love to shoot that as a one-shot video, you know, Garden of Eden, because it would just encapsulate everything you've just talked about. And he goes, yeah, that'd be cool, but, you know, you better ask Axel. And he said, I don't think that, you know, Axel just like... Think about Axel sometimes. If you go off kilter and he's not prepared for it, it's just like his immediate, the default action, you know, reaction is to say no, because he, mm-hmm, you know, he needs time to think about it. So I dropped the idea earlier in the day and he said no. And then a couple of hours, well, later on in the afternoon, I think he was talking to Daniel Pearl, who was the DP. And I'd mentioned it to Daniel because he got a special lens to be sent down. Axel had kind of relaxed by then because we were shooting something else. And Daniel was talking to him. And Daniel said, oh, hey, we're going to do this. Garden of Eden. And he's got this great idea. And I was thinking, oh, Daniel, don't make it worse. And Axel went, yeah, okay, I'll give it a go, a couple of goes. So we set it up and we did it. Did about five takes in a half an hour. And to me, that was a kind of redemptive moment, because I've been, you know, if you imagine those three big videos had taken, you know, nearly a year or over a year to make. And if you weren't in pre-production, you were in shooting or in post-production, and kind of consumed my life for a year or so. And to shoot Garden of Eden in half an hour in kind of took me back to my roots, took them back to their roots, and kind of was my favourite moment I ever had with them, which is completely opposite of the huge videos, ironically. But, you know, I was kind of glad I had that moment. It was, I'd say, very redemptive.
I mean, people who might have watched the great, epic, bombastic Guns N' Roses video, but the Garden of Eden video is brilliant. It is so good. And they're a proper band, and you can tell they're absolutely, totally into it as well.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, that, you know, we recorded the first take, and Axel watched it back and went, "Fucking, you know, I love it. Let's do it again." And they got better at it. You know, the more they saw the confines of this kind of fisheye lens and what they could do within the frame, and there's great bits where like a roadie comes and pushes one of the, you know, our Slash or Duff back into the frame, stuff like that. We just kept all that shit. You know what I mean? Because it was just like totally off the cuff. And you know, that's what I loved about it. So to me, that was a great kind of conclusion to the work I did with them. To kind of finish it off like that was inspiring, really.
Great. Well, that's probably a good way to sum up your experience with Guns N' Roses 30 odd years ago. Maybe we can come back and talk some more about other things.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks for talking to me.
This has been the Promo News Podcast, talking music videos with David Knight and Rob Ulitsky of Promo News, in association with Loop Talent. Our thanks again to Andy Morahan. You can find links to the videos discussed in this podcast and to more work by Andy in the description of this podcast and at promonews.tv, the home for the latest in music video creativity and production news. And subscribe to the Promo News Podcast to hear more of our conversations with leading creatives in the music video industry. Bye for now!